Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Pippa, and thank you to the organisers for asking me to come along this afternoon. What I was asked to do, in fact, was to say a few words about integrated care as a precursor to this panel discussion, which is about patient experience and choice, and in particular to reflect upon what everyone seems to want to do, which is to try to integrate care more, but how to square that with patient choice and competition. That's the domain that I was asked to say a few words about. So I'm going to try and do that in the 5 or 10 minutes I've got now. Okay. So how can the new arrangements facilitate integrated care at home to avoid readmission was the exam question I was set. So I just want to just spend the first few seconds just unpacking that question a little bit. The first thing, which you might think is bleeding obvious, which is what is integrated care, but just so that we're on the same page, care that is coordinated such that patient experience and outcomes are optimised. Okay, that's the best definition I've come across. It is a means to an end, not an end in itself. Okay, integration means across primary and secondary, across health and social care, you know that, across formal or informal self-care. But it's also, those of you who were reading the Hospitals on the Edge report by the RCP a couple of months ago, it's also about integration within secondary care. I think that's the new sort of take, because sitting on that commission, the Future Hospital Commission at the RCP, it's been an eye-opener for me, the extent to which care inside hospital is not as integrated as it could be. So that's integration. Now, what kind of interventions, what can you do to integrate care better? Well, there's a mass of things that are being tried at the moment, from telehealth, telecare, case management, linkage of IT and communications, shared objectives, shared management, shared governance across organisations, self-care, and so on. There's a mass of things that are being used to describe and efforts to integrate care. Does better integrated care avoid readmission or prevent emergency admissions? Now, if you go around the health services, you will hear that everybody thinks it's completely axiomatic that more integration, more care coordination will help to reduce emergency admissions. Okay, and that's what I believe too. However, inconveniently, when you look at the evidence, it's not such a straightforward picture. Now, we at the Nuffield have evaluated a range of integrative care interventions, such as we evaluated the Department of Health integrated care pilots, all 16 of those, telehealth, telecare in the whole system demonstrator project. We went back and evaluated 8 of the POPS programs. Do you remember those? Patient Partnerships for Older People pilot schemes. We've evaluated telephone coaching. We've evaluated virtual wards, things like that. And we use a state-of-the-art evaluative tool, which I won't bore you with, but let's just say it's the state-of-the-art evaluative tool, not just before and after studies. And I have to tell you that the answers from those studies show that there is minimal, if any, I would say probably homeopathic impact on emergency admissions in those studies that we've looked at. Unfortunately, but that is the case so far. And I also point you to a recent systematic review, which I think was published last week by Sarah Purdy and colleagues in Bristol, where they looked at thousands of papers. And let me quote from what they said in their study. It said, "There was evidence," this is the summary, "there was evidence that education stroke self-management, education, rehabilitation and telemedicine in selected patient populations and specialist heart failure interventions can help reduce unplanned admissions. However, the evidence to date suggests that the majority of the remaining interventions included in these reviews do not help reduce unplanned admissions in a wide range of patients. There was insufficient evidence to determine whether home visits, pay-for-performance schemes, A&E services, continuity of care reduces unplanned admissions." Okay, so that's Not all of those will be integrated care, but a lot of those elements are in that systematic review. So that's pretty sobering, but I have to say there are one or two areas that we think have shown promise, and so far the thing, actually, two areas where we find that there is an impact of better integration and better support outside of hospital preventing unplanned admissions. Firstly is a study which we are literally about to publish, which looks at the impact of Marie Curie palliative care on end-of-life patients. And that shows a distinct impact in the last weeks of life in that patients with palliative care at home with Marie Curie have lower emergency unplanned admissions to hospital, which I think everybody agrees is a good thing, because nobody wants to have an unplanned emergency admission when you're within weeks of dying. That's the first sort of area, a glimmer of hope we had. And the second thing is, we also noticed in our analysis at the Trust that social care can substitute for hospital care, particularly in older age groups. So where there is more intensive social care, particularly for the very old, then there is less unplanned emergency admissions. Okay, so that's early findings that we find there. So, but I have to say, probably like you, this whole area is rather counterintuitive. You would imagine that if we all did our absolute utmost to support patients to help them stay at home and integrate care better, that avoidable hospitalizations would be reduced. It's kind of obvious. So our conclusion to date is on why we haven't found more impact is that what the studies have done is they have looked at the intervention that I've described, like telehealth or virtual wards or whatever, but they have ignored the context into which this intervention is plunged. So if you graft on telehealth or virtual wards to an environment in which usual care is operating, then you don't get the synergy that you want from these interventions. So that's conclusion number one. And the analogy I always use, it's if you want to try to do integrated care and you've got your integrated care pet project that you want to try, unless you change the context, it is almost like throwing a seed into stony soil. It's not the seed that's the issue, it's the stony soil that you need to try to do something about to cultivate, to get it more conducive to getting change. And some of these contextual or soil factors, which we think are needed, and we've like others, have studied this over time, well, they're kind of obvious factors. So these factors include, and probably in this order, sustained leadership. That means chief executives that don't change every 2 minutes. It means at least 3 years, hopefully 10. It means detailed information and communication between clinicians, information that can be swapped and analysed, peer-reviewed, benchmarked. It requires clinical engagement, not just reluctant physicians who come along and then realise it's just going to be a flash in the pan and they don't need to engage. It means aligned objectives between managers and clinicians, particularly doctors, and also across services, to the services to be integrated. It requires time. And time is not a year, it's not 2 years, it's probably 5 to 10 years. And that's a coda for relationships and trust to build up and case history to build up. And it probably also requires a much better alignment of the financial incentives in the system than we've hitherto had. So, and all this is underpinned by other work we've done looking at the best integrated systems elsewhere in other parts of the world, including, of course, the United States, but also some in Europe as well. All of those factors need to be present to get the soil right. Too much flux, too much impatience to measure things immediately is not going to produce results. So that's conclusion number one. Conclusion number two is that the evaluations themselves are pretty ropey, most of the ones we've looked at, and could do better. You're not a research audience, I understand, so I won't bang on about that, but let's just say there's a lot more that could be done to make these evaluations cheaper and more robust. Okay, so that's sort of point number one, I guess. The other second area of two that I wanted to talk about today is how can the policy approach to patient choice help facilitate more integrated care that we all want to see, that we all want for our relatives, that we want. And, of course, like you, I hear too often that competition and choice are antithetical to each other and antithetical to collaboration that is needed for integration. Competition doesn't sit alongside collaboration. Well, I don't think that's the case. It's not necessarily so. Sure, our work has shown that sustained relationships between provider networks helps to develop integrated care. You can't do it without those sustained networks. And these networks can, of course, include NHS providers, but also non-NHS providers. And to develop relationships is important, and it's important, therefore, that these networks are not disrupted each year or regularly. So I think that commissioners should be developing, you all know this, preferred provider networks, and actually patients to be guided towards them. Without the preferred provider networks and relationships, you can't get the long-term impact that we all want here. Short-term relations won't work. This doesn't mean curtailing the opportunity for patient choice. In reality, as we know from our analysis, is most of the population still use their nearest NHS trust for elective and non-elective procedures and treatments. And we also know that a lot of the population simply won't travel or don't travel. Older people, people who are socioeconomically in deprived groups, and those needing urgent and emergency care. That's all documented. We know all that. And also, there can be useful competition between preferred networks of providers, and that shouldn't necessarily be discounted, particularly to provide some kind of external challenge. The other comment on the competition policy and choice policy as it is about, of course, any qualified provider. But there again, looking closely at the fine print of AQP for the services that it pertains to, it's fairly obvious what policy is at the moment. And I'm just going to quote you something from the AQP Resource Centre, which is a website that you will be familiar with, I presume. We recognise that choice may not be appropriate where care needs careful coordination and integration, or for people who have many care needs. It is for commissioners to decide how to commission services. Where integration is particularly important, commissioners might decide that one provider is responsible for care planning and delivery while still offering a choice of treatment, setting, and lead clinician. We are not advocating a one-size-fits-all approach to patient choice. The onus would be on commissioners to act transparently and to be able to demonstrate the rationale for their decisions in terms of patient benefits. To emphasise, therefore, commissioners would decide if, when, and how to use competition as a means to an end in improving services. Okay, so that's what AQP says. And overall, looking at all the massive government documents, the bill, the explanatory notes to the Act, all the guidance that's churning out at the moment requiring consultation, it's clear to us that the government intention is to encourage integrated care where it can show benefit to patients and taxpayers. So it's definitely a large thread of government policy. So to finish, the policy approach, what should be the policy approach here at a meta level, is to make it legitimate for CCGs, if it isn't already, to develop relationships with networks of preferred providers that together offer integrated care over an extended period, including social care providers. And these networks can include non-NHS providers as appropriate. Encourage the population to a preferred provider network, where the quality of integrated care is shown to be better. Still allow free patient choice, of course. Encourage the contextual factors. Information, you know, there's been a kind of backseat now taken on Connecting for Health, but that really needs to be looked at again without fear, I think, to get some more movement. Clinical engagement, financial incentives, and sustained leadership. The centre should not just assume that these things can happen locally. That's got to be encouraged over, and cultivated over time. Strongly evaluate the impact of integrated care. It's for commissioners to demonstrate that integration is in patients' benefit, and you'll need those arguments when you're arguing with Monitor, if Monitor is having to adjudicate whether something is anti-competitive or not. As I say, work on Connecting for Health, and perhaps do a little bit more to align financial incentives. We've got quite a smorgasbord at the moment of financial payment currencies, and they don't necessarily all work in the same direction. And in particular, what we've suggested to the commissioning board is they align the pay-for-performance element of the tariff with the QOF, and so the sequin and the best practice tariffs should be aligned a little bit more with the QOF so that there is a pathway incentive that's in the same direction, not just similar things. So those are some thoughts. I'm sorry, that is probably quite a long way from patients and patient choice itself, but that is partly about the overarching policy, the context in which you will be making local decisions to encourage patient choice. I hope that was helpful.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.